The Mandy Connell Show is sponsored by Bell and Pollock Accident and Injury Lawyers.
Now, it's Mandy Connell on KOA News Radio, the voice of Colorado.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to a Thursday edition of the show. I am your host, Mandy Connell, and for the next 3 hours, we will be doing some stuff, some things, you know, some whatnot. Dave the Intrepid here as well.
Yes, I'm full of whatnot today.
What shirt are you wearing? I can't see it. What does it say?
It's opposite. It's
mine's not. From here, it says "Make Orwell Fiction Again." Great shirt.
There you go.
Yeah, I
can. Isn't that cool?
Now, once you backed up, I knew what it said. I just couldn't tell when you were leaning forward. Oh, geez, don't mind the giant mess that just fell on the floor over near me. It's fine. Nothing. No one's hurt. It's look away. Anyway, hey, Michael Coover in today, filling in for Grant, who is going to be off for a few days. Coov, are you full of whatnot today?
I'm full of a lot of stuff that people might say, but I'm just not sure what that is.
Okay, so we'll go with perhaps whatnot, maybe not whatnot. We don't know. We're just going to have to roll the dice and see what happens with Coov.
I'm just happy to be here. That's all I'm going to say. I'm like Nuke Lelouch in Bull Durham.
Coov, I got to tell you. So can I mention the fact that the last two times that you've worked on the show, you've ended up in the emergency room for something?
Yes, and that's not good. The first time I wound up in the emergency room, wound up in the hospital for 2 days. And then last week when Grant got his COVID shot and then came a little ill, they asked me to do it. And I texted back and I go, I'm actually in the hospital right now with kidney stones, so unfortunately I cannot.
So if anybody happens to look over in traffic and see Coov on the way home this afternoon, if you know what he looks like, just give him wide berth, okay? Just like give him a nice cushion around him so he safely get him home. Yeah.
Coov looks a little peaked. You think he's okay?
Well, he just said, he goes, you know, if I end up in the emergency room again, I don't feel good about working your show.
Yeah, that'd have been three times in a row, and I'd have to let the higher ups know, just can't do it.
There's voodoo here that I can't control. Like, maybe we could get a sage stick, we could burn it around the show, you know, have somebody come in, cast some spells, throw some bones, whatever it is people do in the voodoo world these days. I don't know. Everything I learned about voodoo, I learned in the 1960s and 70s film genre, so there you go. There you go. So we're going to have a super fun show. I'm super excited about our guest. I'm so nerded out about this. And we also have the book of questions. But first, I'm going to tell you what's on the blog. Stellar as it always is. You can find it at koanewsradio.com. Click on anything that says Mandy Connell or just look for the headline that says Mandy's Thursday blog, Colorado Wine's Rich History and the Book of Questions. Click on that. And here are the headlines you will find within.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America, all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to press flash.
Today on the blog, Carboy Winery is changing the perception of Colorado wine. The Book of Questions at 2. If you like charter schools, please do this thing now. Remember when global warming caused the super cold polar vortex? I hope you like Sunday day games if you're a Broncos fan. Take it to the track is a great idea to battle street racing. How far do we have to go to help criminals in Colorado? What do all Republican ads need? An eagle and a flag. And now, animals being jerks. Socialized medicine leaves over 400,000 people waiting over a year to begin treatment. We won't have Ellen DeGeneres to kick around anymore. Want to win $1 million? Get a vaccine shot in Ohio. The Israel situation is causing a real issue for Democrats. Let's see how fair the coverage of the fighting is by the networks. There's something missing there. And how to make the Royal Guard laugh. Those are the headlines on the blog at koanewsradio.com, on the Mandy Connell page, and something, there's a headline missing above one of the videos, which is Dr. Fauci's first pitch versus Sister Mary's first pitch. And ladies and germs, there is no comparison. And now the new invective should be hurled. You throw like a doctor instead of you throw like a girl. I'm just saying. Sorry if there's doctors out there throwing.
I've seen dozens and dozens of first pitch throwouts. And they vary from strike fastballs right down the middle, like George Bush.
Yep.
To the worst, you know, to kind of loopy, terrible throws like Barack Obama. But this is the worst. Dr. Fauci
Yeah.
Throws it parallel to his body. I don't know how he did it. But it doesn't go forward. It goes to the side, even though his hand goes forward. This is a guy who, as a kid, was picked last for every game.
Yeah. Yeah. In fairness, Sister Mary.
You got.
She's a baseball legend.
I'm stuck with Fauci this time again.
Yeah. There you go. Anyway, I want to go to the top of the wine, tell you about our guest coming on at 1 o'clock. So you guys know the Wine Yogi. We have Thirsty Thursday. She comes on. We talk about all kinds of stuff. Well, she made me go on a field trip to Carboy Winery. Okay. And I say made me go because I have tried a lot of Colorado wine since I've been out here and I don't think it's good. And I've tried to be kind about it, but I don't think it's good. And I don't drink it as a general rule. So she is my wine sensei. So when she says we're going to do a field trip to Carboy Winery, I do a field trip to Carboy Winery. That's what I do. And I got to meet Kevin Weber. Kevin is part of the team at Carboy, and he was kind enough to give us a couple hours of his time. And I learned so much about the history of wine in Colorado that is very interesting. And it's not just because it's wine history, because I know wine's not for everyone, but it also gives you a window into the world of what Colorado was like back in the early 1900s. So there's kind of a political aspect to it, but it was a very interesting story, but it explains why a lot of Colorado wine is not great wine, in my opinion. And I'm not naming names. There's a lot of people who love Colorado wine, and more power to you. I'm not trying to put anybody down, but there's a whole reason. Our climate, old vines versus new vines, the kind of grapes that we have and why we have them. Super interesting stuff. So he's coming up at 1 o'clock to talk about that. And then we've got the Book of Questions coming up at 2. Kuv, did Grant leave you the keys to the closet for the big wheel? Did he leave those for you, or did he take those with him?
He did. Maleficent actually dropped by and gave me a spinning wheel.
Great. Perfect.
And she put it in there. Hopefully, if I touch the needle, I'm not going to get like put into some
sleep mode. No, you'll be fine. It'll be fine. And if you do, we're not taking you to the emergency room.
Okay.
Just letting you know. It'll be fine. Wait, on the record, do we have, in case it requires the kiss of your true love, do we have your permission to find that and kiss you without a consent form?
Yes.
That goes back to an earlier topic from last week.
Yes, so, that'll work. Yeah.
All right, perfect. Just clearing that up. Also on the blog today, we have a bill in the legislature that will severely curtail the options when it comes to charter schools dealing with anti-charter school boards. School boards are elected positions. They change from time to time. And we cannot have charter schools at the whims of school boards who are being elected with the help of teachers unions who despise charter schools because charter schools make a lot of traditional public schools look bad. That's the reality. That is why unions hate charter schools, because they're not beholden to the union. They don't have to deal with the union, and they can set their own agendas and their own curriculums. And in a lot of cases, charter school students achieve at a very high level. I am a charter school parent. If you're not a charter school parent, here's why I need you to do this anyway. If you want to allow other parents with children to continue to have educational options for their children that do not come with the hardcore left-wing teachers union progressive agenda, then I certainly hope you would support charter schools in your community, because a lot of charter schools are not, that's not their what they're set about to do. It's not like they're like, let's show those progressives. But what they do is, in many cases, is teach a more classical curriculum, focusing on the readings, basics, grammar, math, things like that. And instead of all the other gobbledygook that is being shoved down the kids, these kids' throats now in public schools, it's terrible. So if you want to make sure that parents have that option and have options in the future for charter schools, I need you to go to this website. I need you to fill this out. I need you to send a letter to your legislator that has to defeat this legislation. What this legislation does is, currently, if a charter renewal or a charter an initial charter is declined by a school board for a specious reason, as in they just don't like charter schools, now charter schools and charter operators have the option of going to the state and making their case to the state. And if the school board just denies the charter or doesn't renew the application because of a specious reason, like they don't think that we need charter schools and the teachers unions are telling them to do it, and don't think that doesn't happen, it's happening in Denver right now. then you have the option of going to the state and making your case, and the state can override the school board. Well, the state did that in Denver when the school board and school board members like Tay Anderson lied about giving a charter to a new charter high school. He lied about it during the campaign, and then he went back on his word. He lied. I just want to point that out. He and other school board members, they appealed to the state, and the state looked at their application and said, sure, you've done everything you need to do. Make it happen. And they're mad, and now they're trying to do it. This will be colossally, colossally damaging to charter schools if this passes. I need you to just go fill this form out. It sends an automated email. If you really want to go crazy, call your legislator. I live in solidly Republican districts. They're going to vote against this, but I sent a letter and I made a call too. Okay, so we have to let them know how important this is. Charter schools serve 113,000 people in this state. They are free public schools, but they operate outside the control of the teachers union, and that's why people hate them. And guess what? Many of the highest performing schools in Colorado are charter schools. That's who they're attacking. They want them to be as mediocre as everybody else. I'm just throwing that out there. Yes, Dave, go ahead.
What would be their rationale for passing this legislation? What do they say is their purported goal for proposing this law in the first place?
Well, they say it's about local control, Dave. It's about local control. You know, we should allow people in that community to make it. It's about union control is what it's about, under the guise of local control. And I'm not saying that school boards shouldn't have any say in this. And if a school board has a series of valid reasons that they should not approve a charter or renew a charter, I'm all for that. But when you say we're going to go ahead and move forward with this, and let me give you the specifics of this example. I can do it really quick. So Knoll High School was going to be the school for Knoll Middle School, which has been very, very successful. Very high-performing charter school. They wanted to create a high-performing high school to go along with it. When the middle school charter was approved, it was approved with the understanding that when the kids were ready to loop up and go from eighth grade to ninth grade, they would have this other high school charter approved. And then the school board used the performance of a completely different school owned by the same company to use that school's performance to keep the charter of the high school from being approved. Does that make sense? It was a reason that had nothing to do with the two schools that we were talking about. Nothing. And so that's not a valid reason. It just isn't. Come up with a performance plan to improve the other school. Absolutely. But it's that kind of stuff. It's these shady maneuvers by school board members like Tay Anderson and his ilk that are completely in the pocket of the teachers unions, because that's who gives them money to run. That's who runs $1 million in outside advertising. You know, I have nothing but love for teachers and nothing but absolute. I despise the teachers union with every fiber of my being, because they don't care about my kids. They don't care about your kids. They don't care about anybody's kids. If they did, they would be looking at what the charter schools are doing and encouraging those reforms within the public traditional school system. But they never do that. They never do that, ever. Doesn't anybody ever ask why? I'm just saying. Moving on. Hey, Dave, remember when the polar vortex that swooped down into America and brought the jet stream way down, it froze us all for like a month and a half, and it was super cold, and we were all like, oh, it was super cold. And all of the people were like, you know why it's so cold? Global warming. Do you remember this? It was nonsense.
Yes.
But here's the rationale. The rationale was, well, you know, that the more Arctic ice melts, then it releases more heat into the atmosphere, which causes a loosening of the belt of wind that holds all the cold air in. And then the belt gets too loose and the jet stream whips on down through the U.S. And that's why global warming causes it to be freezing cold. Okay. Someone studied that very supposition. Someone actually did a study on it. They used comprehensive modeling, Dave. Comprehensive. Not just this slipshod, you know, shallow modeling. They went comprehensive in their modeling. And guess what they found out? That is totally wrong. They're like, sorry, that would have such a minuscule effect on where the jet stream goes because of the sheer strength of the jet stream. That just... So I love this. And what's funny is another scientist came back because he had posited something else. And another scientist came back and was like, nuh-uh, your modeling's wrong. And I'm like, wait a minute. So you're telling me the climate modeling that we're basing huge, huge economic decisions that can change the trajectory of the of our country right now. Are you telling me that modeling can be bad? What? I'm being sarcastic for that person who's already sending me an email. I'm just saying. So that's another one down, Dave. Boof. Poof. Yeah. Yeah. If you read geophysical research letters like I do, you too would have known that. Let's see here. What else? What else? What else? Oh, yeah. The Broncos schedule came out yesterday. Hey, Coov, you're a sports guy. Let me ask you a quick question, you know, because we don't talk about sports much on this show, but I'm going to just guess. It doesn't say good things about the league's predictions for the Broncos season when you look at when they are playing their games. Is that a fair assertion?
Somewhat. I mean, obviously, they've been down the last, what, 5 years? They haven't made the playoffs in 5 years. Obviously, only one primetime game this year, and that's a Thursday night one.
Yeah.
They're not on Monday night football for the first time in 29 years. But guess what? If they happen to get Aaron Rodgers here, all of a sudden they get flexed in, and then you'll see them all over the place. And oh, by the way, if they don't start the season 3-0, it's going to be a long year because they start with the Giants, the Jaguars, and the Jets.
I'd like Jaguars. Thank you. Jaguars.
The Jags, for short. But yeah, if they don't start 3-0, it's going to be a long year for them. But they have a chance to get off to a great start, and then optimism will reign high here in Denver, regardless if it's Teddy or Drew.
I actually really like Teddy Bridgewater. I was in Louisville while he was at Louisville, so I watched him play.
He was good back in the day.
He was very, very good. He's got great legs. I mean, he just needs, I don't know. There's something missing in how he reads a defense, but that's a story for another time. All right. Also, let me do this. Is Susan Witkin in her little box right now? Is she ready to go? In your box, in your news box. It's the freshest news box around. You keep big holes at the top. An easy tray for cleaning at the bottom. It's fine. What do you have in the news for me? We are back. Okay, so on the break, you know, the best show happens on the break. Dave told me earth-shattering news, and that is that Frank Perdue, the founder of Perdue Chicken, actually looked like a chicken. And now that I have investigated, Dave is correct. Frank Perdue did it.
Years ago, he used to do all his own commercials back when I was living in New York. And I used to say, God, he looks like the product.
Yeah, he does. You know? He even has kind of little beady chicken eyes. And no disparagement, I love Perdue chicken. It's my favorite chicken.
I mean, I only buy chicken from a guy who looks like one, so that's fine.
Figuring the takes one to know one strategy is a good way to buy chicken.
He knows chicken.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, if you've ever been on 225 late at night and had people whiz by you going 130 miles an hour, you know that street racing is alive and well in Denver. It has created huge problems. It has gotten people killed. And the Colorado State Patrol has teamed up with the great family at Bandimere Speedway to encourage people to take it to the track in a program. Wednesday night, you can take anything to the track at Bandimere and race it on the drag strip. I think this is cool. And as a matter of fact, my middle son is about to buy a truck, and he jokingly said to his dad, we'll see who can take who off the line. And I was like, okay, we're taking it to Bandimere. We're going. It'll be mano a mano when the truck thing happens. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of cool. Very interesting story from the Denver Gazette, an editorial rather, about the legislation that's been passed in the last few years, designed with well intentions, good intentions behind all of it, trying to help people who have been in the prison system have an opportunity to rebuild their lives when they come out. And I think everybody's in favor of second chances. I don't think anyone, you know, would say nobody ever deserves a second chance if they're truly sorry. Well, the laws that have been passed over the last few years are starting to have some negative consequences. And not for the reformed criminals we're talking about. It's, you need to start educating yourself about what some of these things are going to do, because now they're looking at no cash bail, which has been an absolute disaster in California. And I tried to find it this morning on Twitter. I will find it because I read the whole Twitter thread. A police department in California outside Los Angeles arrested the same guy 4 times in 6 hours for 4 different crimes in 6 hours because of their no bail. And it's insane what's happening there. Absolutely insane. It's going to happen here. So we need to start paying attention to it. If you're not familiar with The Oyster, it's a new satire site that writes very funny stuff about Colorado. Dave, what do every Republican ads need? By gosh, by golly. Well,
humor?
They need an eagle and a flag. That's what they have. And the whole column is about a guy who had a heart attack because he saw a mailer that did not have an eagle and a flag in it. And he got very upset and had to, you know, it's funny. I thought it. And now Dave and I were just talking about this, animals being jerks. Like 8 or 9 minutes of animals being jerks to other animals.
I like this.
Wildly entertaining.
I like this because, you know, 99.9% of animal YouTubes are cute and adorable.
No.
No matter what the animal is, they're always acting cute and adorable. These are animals who are jerks.
Exactly.
To people, to each other, to every living thing.
Yeah.
They break stuff. They're angry. They're growling. They're hitting things.
One dog pushes a cat into a bathtub with water in it, and that one made me laugh out loud. Because you can see, the dog's like, hey, there you go. He just, very casually. The screen grab is a German shepherd smushing a cat's face in the snow. It's awesome.
Bully dog.
Exactly.
Bully dog. But my favorite one was the two cats, one in a closet with the door half closed, the other one innocently just sitting in front of it. And you can see the half open door and the cat waiting to hit the other cat with a left hook to the mouth. Just, you know, quick yeah. one. And then he's back inside the little house that he has.
He's a ninja.
That's really nasty,
ninja.
jerky cat.
I thought they were hilarious. Yeah, I thought it was
hilarious. Yeah, I love this.
I've got to thank an emailer and for sending me this. In the UK right now, in the United Kingdom, their socialized medicine system has a waiting list of over 400,000 people who have been waiting a year to start treatment. A year. Y'all, some of these people have cancer. Does anybody even know of a cancer that gets better after waiting a year to start treatment? Anyone? No.
Yeah, the system is a death sentence for these people, basically.
It really so I sent this article to my friend Michelle, who just had her gallbladder out, and you know, by the way, we are getting her on the show. I just had to do an equipment change out, and we've had some technical bugs this week that we've had to work out before I can record her interview. Nonetheless, she pointed out that's just in Britain. That doesn't include Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. That waiting list is just in Britain. I'm thinking, holy crap. I mean, but please tell us how socialized medicine is fair. Of course, it's fairly bad for everyone. That's the way it goes. Dave, bad news. I know that you are a huge Ellen DeGeneres fan and that you watch every day.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait.
Dave practically races to watch his recorded version of Ellen every day after the show. Well, Ellen is wrapping up her talk show at the end of 2022.
Say it ain't so.
It's true. Dave, it's true.
No.
Yeah.
What will I do?
Well, I'm more concerned about who her staff is going to get that will make them cry on a regular basis. Like who? I mean, you just you can't find a boss like that that's going to make you cry on a regular basis. You know, with
she's
little
special.
Effort. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So this is interesting. Out of the state of Ohio, do you want the opportunity to win $1 million in Ohio? Well, all you have to do is show your proof of vaccination. This is an interesting tact. And if it works, expect it to be rolled out in Colorado and every other state that's trying to encourage people to get vaccinated. And by the way, if you're holding out, I'd love to know, would this push you over the edge? Would the chance to win $1 million, because you got to think the odds for this are going to be way better than the lottery. Just the numbers,
yeah.
You know?
Especially it's only within the state. So how
exactly
your chances have to be much better.
Exactly. So why not? Somebody's going to win it. It's not like the lotto where it's just going to roll over. You know, someone is going to win $1 million.
The thing is, it's a good idea because to have the mentality that you don't want the vaccine matches perfectly with the mentality that I could win the lottery.
Shh, Dave, don't point that out. Stop it. Don't say anything. You're blowing the whole thing, Dave. Stop.
In other words, they're both kind of dumb, in my opinion.
But if it works, this is the kind of incentive, if it gets people off the schneid and says, okay, finally, I'll go ahead and do it. None of my friends have died.
Yeah, so much for safety and all that stuff. If I can win $1 million, throw all that out the window. That's fine.
Exactly. You got money to, you know, take care of yourself later.
Yeah, but you're right. If it works,
yeah,
good. Let's do it.
Expect to see it in other states, including probably this one. The situation in Israel is deteriorating. Now rockets are being fired nonstop. You know, isn't it amazing how many rockets Hamas has since all they get is humanitarian aid? Isn't that weird?
And I'm sure it all goes for humanitarian purposes.
Yeah.
I don't know where those bombs and rockets come from.
No, and I think it's only getting started right now. They're massing troops on the border with Gaza. And you guys, when we say massing troops, that would be like them massing troops. I'm trying to think of the appropriate city. How far away? Maybe in Westminster, you know, to go from Denver, it would be like, I'm going to get the exact specifications. Israel is tiny. It is a tiny country. So when they say we're massing troops on the border of Gaza, that's in the middle of a city. Things are getting very, very bad. And as a completely secondary, almost bonus for those of us who enjoy this kind of stuff, this situation could be incredibly damaging to Democratic Party unity. You know, there's a serious rift in the Democratic Party right now between the old guard and the new guard, and it's significant, but they're better at pulling it together than the Republicans are, as witnessed by the removal of Liz Cheney from her leadership position. They're just better at maintaining a united front. But on this, they are not united at all. Noted anti-Semite Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez criticized President Biden, who, by the way, has done nothing. Nothing. He's been nowhere on this. War is breaking out right now, and dude is like, oh, it'll be fine. It's mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing. So he made his milquetoast comments about how Israel had a right to defend itself, which it totally does. But that's like stating the obvious. There's no passion.
Well, it wasn't obvious to Ocasio-Cortez.
Oh, no. No. Now she's calling him out for supporting Israel at all. She accused him of, quote, taking the side of the occupation. You know what kills me about people who are like, you're occupying Palestinian territory? Do you know what the Temple on the Mount is built on? I mean, do you know what the most holy site in that part of the region for Muslims is in Jerusalem? It's built on top of a holy site of the Israelis. So if you want to talk about who was there first, doesn't that give you a little bit of information on who was there first? If somebody built something on top of somebody else's stuff. So the notion that this is somehow squatting, I'm just so over it. My patience. I want the Palestinian people to have peace, to be able to raise their families in a place that they feel safe and comfortable and that rockets won't be flying back and forth. But be clear about one thing right now. If Israel stops bombing, if the Palestinians stop flying rockets at Israel, the bombing will stop. Full stop. That's it. That's all you need to know. If they stop hurling rockets, there will be no more fighting. Now, if the Palestinians put down their arms, there is peace. If the Israelis put down their arms, they are destroyed. That's the reality of the Middle East situation as it is right now. And I don't really care how you feel about Jewish people. I really don't. Israel is our strongest ally in that region. The only ally we have in that region. And they have a right not to face genocide again, period. And if you wonder why the Israeli leadership pushes back so hard, you know what? They're just hurling rockets. It's a disproportionate response. This is the same group of people who have a nation right now because 6 million of them were exterminated while no one else was paying attention. They are never going to let themselves be put in a position where they face extermination again. They're not waiting for somebody else to come in and do something and negotiate something. They're going to protect themselves, and it's going to be disproportionate. And all they want is to be allowed to exist. They're not asking to expand their borders. They're not asking for anything other than the right to exist and practice their faith freely. So everybody who wants to talk to me about the Palestinian situation, you better know you will not change my mind. Because I have given this an incredible amount of thought. I've been to Israel. I've seen the situation firsthand. I know where my feelings are. And I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is motivated by anti-Semitism. That's what I learned from Democrats, by the way. When you disagree with them, you just call them a name. So anti-Semite Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is calling out the president because of his tacit milquetoast support of Israel. And this is going to be a problem going forward. Because you got Bob Menendez, who is in no mood, coming from New Jersey with a large Jewish contingent to deal with this kind of crap coming out of AOC's mouth. And her district, by the way, doesn't have any Jews in it. So she doesn't care. I think that the Jewish people of the United States of America have been taken for granted by the Democrats for a very long time. A very long time. And when I hear people ask a question like, how can black people like Donald Trump because he's such a racist? I think to myself, well, I have to trust those black people to make that decision based on the reason they like him. Maybe it's his policies. Maybe they were flourishing under Donald Trump. I don't know. Maybe they just like a guy who doesn't take crap from anybody. Whatever it is. For a long time, I think to myself, the Jewish people have to make up their own mind. But at what point do you not look at some of these people and say, you know what? They really don't like me. I don't know. I don't know how to process that. I am not Jewish. That is a struggle that someone else has to have. But I have always wondered about that. It's like, Man, I just got this on the text line. This $1 million lottery is one way to get your tax money back from the government. Good point. Good point. Wondering how many folks are going to get multiple COVID shots to try and win that $1 million, not to mention free drinks, game tickets, and other incentives. You can't enter more than once. Yeah, why would you? That would just be dumb. Yes, Dave.
I'm just curious, where does this $1 million they're awarding come from?
They're COVID dollars from the federal government. So your tax dollars and mine are paying for somebody in Ohio to win $1 million for being vaccinated.
Because they're reluctant to take a shot and this is going to convince them. Wonderful.
Dave, we're working with what we've got here, okay? It's a better carrot than a stick, don't you think? I'll take the carrot over the stick all day long.
I guess if it gets us to herd immunity, it'll be worth it. But boy, it's kind of ridiculous that we have to do this sort of thing.
Yeah. One more thing about Israel and the Palestinian situation currently. There was a report early on that 9 Palestinian children died at the hands of Israelis. That has turned out to be a complete fabrication, but our news media decides to run with it. There is an organization, an NGO, non-governmental organization, doing work on the ground. They pointed out that though CBS chose to ignore the death of a 6-year-old Israeli boy, they ran with the false story, and now this organization said, wait a minute, some of those Palestinian children were killed by rockets fired by Hamas that did not make it into Israel and fell short in the Gaza Strip, and the kids were there. Because why not bring your kids to a war? Can't get a sitter? Susan Witkin is in the newsroom in her news box.
I am in my news box.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's padded. I'm going to start decorating it.
I think I need some zhuzhing.
Zhuzh up my news box. I want to bling it.
There you go. There you go.
Okay. Hey, get a vaccine. You know, and wait a minute. Get a vaccination. Take off your mask. That's an incentive, too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Instead of the $1 million that they're giving away at that state, you know, just
yep.
You got to take off your mask. Wouldn't that be nice?
I'm ready.
1 o'clock right here. KOA News Radio, 850 AM, 94.1 FM.
The Mandy Connell Show is sponsored by Bell and Pollock Accident and Injury Lawyers.
Now, it's Mandy Connell on KOA News Radio, the voice of Colorado.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the second hour of the show. And I am pleased as punch to have a guy I just recently met when the wine yogi dragged me on a field trip to a Colorado winery against my will. I did not want to go. I've not had great experiences with Colorado wine, and boy, am I glad that I listened to her, because Carboy Winery is really remarkable, not just because they're making incredibly good Colorado wine, but I got to meet Kevin Weber. He works with Carboy behind the scenes, and he is like a walking encyclopedia of Colorado wine knowledge. And I feel like after talking to him, I have a much better understanding of why Colorado wine is as it is. And I'm really excited about some of the cool stuff that Carboy specifically is doing. So Kevin has agreed to join us today to spread a little of his wine knowledge to a greater audience than just me. And hopefully you'll all be as geeked out about it as I was. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Mandy. It's good to see you again.
So, Kevin, let's talk for a second about Colorado wine. Let's do a little history lesson on Colorado wine, because there's a lot of stuff that went on that shouldn't really have an impact on grapes in Colorado, but did, and it goes back to Prohibition. Is that where it starts, or does it start before that?
Well, I mean, Colorado viticulture really existed back in the 1880s. And it was, you're right, Prohibition that really kind of put a damper on things, because, you know, Colorado was so ambitious as to be one of the first states to sign on to Prohibition. And so what that did, and it didn't just impact Colorado's viticultural scene, it really impacted the entire country, because grape growers everywhere were having to rip up their vines and plant orchards and other things. And so there was a huge lull there. There was a lot of planted acres back then. And then, you know, around the 30s, you know, Vitis vinifera vines started becoming, you know, getting planted back in the Grand Valley again. And so there was a period of time where, you know, it just really was stagnant. And as most things that have to be planted, things take time to come back. And so it wasn't until about 19, I want to say it was like the 70s, where Warren Winiarski, who founded Stag's Leap in Napa Valley, came back to Colorado and along with Gerald Ivancy, really, you know, fostered the growth of Colorado wine again and encouraged farmers to replant. So that was kind of the humble beginnings that we are in for a state.
So let's talk for a second about what grows well in Colorado and what doesn't, because one of the things that I have now learned about the growing season overall, we have a very short growing season. And one thing I've learned from the Wine Yogi is that wine is very persnickety about things like sugar content and how long it has to ripen on the vine and water and all of those things. They have such a huge effect on the quality of the grapes themselves. Are we growing the right kind of grapes here? What grows well and what has grown here in the past?
Well, you're right. You know, to understand the growing region here in Colorado, it is a shorter growing season. You know, where the average elevation in the Grand Valley is about 4,700 feet. And so that close, you know, we always talk about, you know, wearing sunscreen when you're at altitude because you're that much closer to the sun. Well, the same thing exists for things that grow. And so, you know, that high altitude, that short growing season, that huge diurnal shift of daytime highs and nighttime lows, it really makes it challenging for grapes. But that doesn't mean that they don't grow here. So I think, and by and large, a lot of the grapes that have been planted, you know, going all the way back to the 70s, it was mostly farmers planting grape varieties that the consumer is familiar with and also was grabbing on store shelves, like Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And those are grapes that require a little bit longer hang time. And, you know, that's why in places like California, where, you know, it's a little bit easier for those grapes to grow. And so the things that grow really well here are grapes that can handle that harsh climate, you know, those sun-drenched days, the early season frosts and late season freeze events that come in October and can ripen relatively, you know, quickly comparatively. And so we look at a lot of things that grow similarly and in other places in the world that have similar climates like Spain and Argentina. And so some of the things that our grower partners grow are Tempranillo and Malbec and Albarino, and they may not be your most household name varietals, but they're starting to become, you know, more recognized as time goes on and the consumer becomes more educated.
You took it back to the 1970s for a couple comments there. And I feel like since the 1970s, when, you know, in the 70s, my parents had the giant bottle of Chianti that everyone had. That God only knows what was actually in that bottle of Gallo, you know. But since then, we've really seen kind of an explosion of wine across the United States. And they have people, when I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, I was shocked to find out that there are some really great small wineries in Indiana. You don't necessarily think about that as a possibility. So has that growth over the last, I guess, now 50 years, to your point, before that, where they were planting grapes because people wanted Chardonnay, now it seems like there's a lot more focus on what grows well where, no matter where the grape originated. It's like, to your point, I love Malbec and Tempranillo. Those are two of my absolute favorite wines. So I'm excited to hear that we're doing that in Colorado now. But do you feel like there's more looking around the world and saying, okay, what is where we are? What grows in a place like we are here? Is that's what's happening now?
Yeah, I mean, in all 50 states, there are winemakers and there are grapes that are grown, and a lot of people don't realize that. So, they're just not always going to be those grape varieties that, you know, that everyone's heard of. You know, there's challenges uniquely geographically all over the place. In Texas, it's really hot, but they found grapes that grow really well out there. And same thing up in the Midwest. You know, the University of Minnesota was famous for really pioneering a lot of cold hardy hybrid varietals that are. You know, I always joke around in the tasting rooms that when people say, what are you talking about between, you know, Vitis vinifera and, you know, those hybrid varieties? And I'm like, it's kind of like Game of Thrones. It's like, you know, here's Westeros and then these are the wildlings, you know? And that's like my way of making it relative to today. But these are grapes that are a little bit more cold resistant and a little hardier. And so we started planting these here in Colorado a long time ago. And there just really wasn't in the beginning a lot of wineries that were really interested in these grapes. They're largely unknown. Some of them have different aromas and different flavor profiles than some of the grapes that we all are familiar with. But in that, we saw a challenge that, you know, hey, you know, Colorado, you know, viticulturally, we just had a huge setback as a state this past October.
Yeah.
We suffered a freeze event that really killed a lot of the vines out in Grand Valley. And so it's really forcing us as a state to look at what can we replant that's going to be resistant to those types of natural events. And so some of these fun hybrid grapes are going to be where we think some of the future for Colorado wine is.
Do we have any native grapes that would be appropriate, you know, that you can kind of harken back to, even if you just use it to bring a hybrid forward?
You know, I don't know if there are any indigenous grapevine varieties that, you know, that just have been here forever. To my knowledge, they've all been planted. That's hard for CSU would be a better outlet for whether or not that happens. I would guess not, just based upon the climate and of the Grand Valley. You know, it's
right.
Because it's very high and dry. You know, it doesn't strike me as a place where grapes naturally grow.
Well, my producer Dave had a question for you.
Yeah. Kevin, if there was a U.S. competition for wines, every state having to have one candidate, what would be Colorado's? This is the best thing Colorado has.
You know, that's a really interesting question. You know, a lot of us in the wine industry here in Colorado have kind of felt, you know, and I'll just speak for myself here. I've always felt like Colorado needs a varietal identity. You know, when you think of Napa Valley, Cabernet comes to mind. You think of New Zealand, you think Sauvignon Blanc. You think of Oregon, you think Pinot Noir. But when you think about Colorado wine, it's really kind of a mixed bag, right? So I have always felt like Cabernet Franc could be that grape for Colorado, especially because it's so unique. And something that I always talk about, and our entire team is really good at painting that context, that picture of how Colorado wine should taste. You know, wine is a very, very specific taste that comes from, you know, the terroir and the region. So French wine doesn't taste like California wine. And so Colorado wine shouldn't taste like either. And so when we paint that context, people are free and open to objectively judge the wine for what it is, not holding it to an unfair standard that it can't meet. And so I always felt like Cab Franc was that one grape, red grape varietal that really could solidify Colorado and then also sparkling wine.
I was going to say, you're keen on the sparkling wines. I know that.
We're keen on sparkling because a lot of these cold hardy varieties that we're growing here now, they're perfectly situated to be, you know, great sparkling wines because they're higher acid profile. They're really aromatic. They're, you know, we don't struggle with the growth out here with them. And so they really lend themselves to making great still wine for sparkling. And so we've invested heavily in that with our sparkling program at our Denver location. And then the new location that we're opening in Palisade, we're going to have between 4 and 6 Chamonix takes where we're going to be making Chamonix method sparkling wine. So I think sparkling wine and Cab Franc are the two things that can really make Colorado stand out and have its own national identity.
And I have to say, the Carboy has their Native Fizz sparkling that is just so... I've given it now to like 8 people. And I just say, you have to try this. It's so good. You know, it's the wine of summer, Kevin. It's the wine of summer. You know, going back to talking about that evolution, how long have you guys been planting grapes specifically? You kind of mentioned we've been doing this a long time. How long does it take from planting a group of vines to having them get to a point where they're producing regularly in a way that you want that to happen?
Yeah. Well, and when I say we, I'm speaking collectively as a state, as an industry. So, you know, there have been, you know, I really look at the 90s is where things started to take off. You started to see some big production of wines and acreage planted out there. And really the growth has really warped speed the last 5 to 10 years. But for us personally at Carboy, we work with a handful of growers out in the Grand Valley, grower partners that we have great relationships with. These are great people, great farmers. And then we just purchased our first 2 vineyards out there. And a lot of those growers are gonna help us manage those vineyards. But that's how long we've been growing. I'm sorry, Mandy.
How long does it take to get a vine in the ground to have it become a producing on a reliable producer? We'll call
usually
it that way.
About 2 to 3 years.
Oh, that's so not bad. That's not as bad as I thought it would be.
And that's also part of the reason why the industry here has been kind of a slow growth when you compare it to craft beer and distilling, because you can make craft beer in 2 weeks.
Right.
With the wine industry, though, you only get one harvest. And so whatever lessons that you learn, mistakes that you have to overcome, you can only get to make those changes year over year. And then you have to, by the way, deal with whatever Mother Nature throws at you. So it's not a controlled environment like when you're making beer. So you have to deal with variables. And we've always put a positive spin on that, you know, that's the adventure that is Colorado wine, that, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. Harvests year to year, it can totally dictate the way that the wine tastes. And I think that's kind of fun, because as much as I love the old reliable of buying like a Sonoma Pinot Noir, I know what it's going to be like every single year. I get excited every year knowing that a Colorado wine could be drastically different than it was the year before. So that kind of keeps me coming back. But it's about 2 to 3 years before we're going to find out, you know, what we've replanted and how they're going to turn out. And really that year four or five is where they reach, you know, maturity, mm-hmm. where they're really right where we want them to be.
So, you know, at least you're not in the bourbon business. Sometimes you got to wait 20 years to find out if that batch came out okay. So that's a waiting game right there.
Yeah.
What are, you know, you have some very interesting blends. I brought home a bottle of the, and I cannot remember what it's called. Is it the Pinot? What is it? I'll think of it in a second.
Petite Pearl?
Yes,
maybe?
Petite Pearl. That's it. And my niece was here, and she loves wine, and she loves to go to Napa Valley with her friends, so she's wine knowledgeable. And she goes, "Oh, what kind of grapes does it have?" I read them off the back. She's like, "I've never heard of any of those." So, is that kind of what you're talking about? Because she loved the wine, but how do you get past the wine snob who says, "I only drink Cabernet Sauvignon"? You know, they're out there. Do you just say, "Look, give it a try," because the wine will stand up to your expectations, even if you know nothing about the grape?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, like we're not in California, so there's not this standard that we're being held to. And there's also not this traditional establishment. One of the beauties about being in Colorado is that we're a really innovative state with pretty much every industry, and we're always looking at the next thing. And so when we first opened our doors in Littleton in 2016, largely our business model was a negociant winery where we would purchase grapes and juice and wine from other regions, and we would bring it here to Littleton, and our winemaker would change it, age it, barrel it, make it our own. And we kind of got our first, you know, consumers to trust us that we make good wine through that. And then once we had that customer loyalty and that trust, when we unveiled our Colorado program, which is now, you know, most 90% of our business model is working in Colorado viticulture, though we still do a fair amount out of state for our tap program. Because we have that consumer trust with them, that opens the door for them to say, hey, I really liked this Pinot Noir you guys made from California years ago. I'm willing to try pretty much whatever you put in front of me. So we put things like Petite Pearl or Teraldigo or Verona in front of them. And even they don't know anything about the grape, but if it's packaged nice and it tastes good and they're open to learning and listening about it, it's pretty much a blank canvas. And I don't think you can get away with that in every state.
The Petite Pearl doesn't taste like anything you've ever had. And I mean that in the best possible way. It is just, it's almost confusing, you know?
It was one of the most fun accidents. You know, we harvested that as a pilot program. One of our growers, his name's Kaibab Savage. He's a great farmer. He's been, he grows some of the best grapes in Colorado. He always had these Petite Pearl grapes, and he said he could never get anybody to buy them. So our head winemaker, Tyzok, he said, you know, I'll try them out. And so the initial intent, you know, these grapes come in, they're really tiny, dark, dark clusters. And we weren't really sure what we were going to do with it. Tyzok was actually going to make rosé out of it. Well, as he started to make rosé, he started to realize that this was not going to work. So he ended up barreling it and making a red wine that was really deep in color and character. And that first go around with Petite Pearl, he did 100% whole cluster, meaning he's crushing and pressing with the stems and the seeds and everything in there. And it had this we weren't really sure how it was going to evolve. And then it turned into this really beautiful, savory wine that doesn't have a lot of those foxy aromas that some of the hybrid varieties can have. It actually had this really kind of beautiful plum note that was surrounded by tomato vine, so not the tomato, but like the actual vine. So it was a green note that you could sometimes get in wine that we've never even experienced before. And so it quickly became kind of a cult wine for us, and we've harvested it every single year. And I think the one I sent home with you was year number two working with Petite Pearl, where
fantastic.
We completely destemmed it. We made it in a much softer, more approachable style, but it still really had that fun, savory tomato vine characteristic that every Psalm I put it in front of is just like blown away by.
It's delicious. We're talking to Kevin Weber with Carboy Winery. Kevin, can you hang around so we'll continue this conversation on the other side of the break? I want to talk about your new joint in Palisades. I want to talk about that.
Perfect.
Plus, you guys have all these wine tastings and wine dinners. We're going to talk about that with Kevin, but first we're going to check in with Susan Witkin, find out what's happening in the news.
There is a new guy at the top of the Pac-12, and I'll tell you about him at 1:30 right here on KOA News Radio, 850 AM and 94.1 FM.
It's making you thirsty.
Back with Kevin Weber from Carboy Winery. He's joined us talking about wine, Colorado wine specifically. You know, Kevin, I think it's very interesting how you ended up in the wine business. And I wanted to start with that, but then I got all nerded out and I jumped right into the wine questions. How did you end up doing, you know, working in the wine business?
That story is more interesting than mine, although although it is a fun story. So I'll kind of keep it short. So I've got 20 years of hospitality experience, you know, from the restaurant side mostly, and selling wine back in those fine dining restaurant days. And it really was just, you know, I always kind of wanted to work for a winery, but I was never leaving Colorado. I'm a native, and I love skiing in the wintertime. I just wasn't going to move out west. And so one day, I think it's 2015, my friends Craig Jones and Eric Hyatt, who founded Angelo's Taverna on 6th Avenue, or the rebirth of Angelo's Taverna on 6th Avenue, it had actually been there for like 40 years, they approached me and said, hey, you know, we want to open a winery here in Denver. And I was like, okay. So, I mean, I said yes to it. You know, I had a strong Psalm background and sales background and marketing. And so we launched it in 2016 in Littleton, And like I mentioned in the last segment, you know, we, our original business model was just working with out-of-state growers because, you know, we had opened post-harvest here. We hadn't really developed those relationships with the growers on the Western Slope. And really the model was just one location. We were just, that was all we were going to do, just bring an innovative, fun wine experience to Denver and do 1 liter growler fills, or carboy fills, we call them, of wine to go. And it really wasn't until 2017 when we did our pilot program that we of Colorado Fruit that the head winemaker and myself said, you know, we really want to do Colorado wine. And we felt validated at Aspen Food and Wine when that's all anybody was talking about. And so the rest is kind of history. And since then, my roles have changed and evolved. And now we're almost four locations later and two new vineyard purchases. And you know, it's just funny how things happen.
So you kind of stumbled into four locations. You got a new location opening up in Palisades, and this one's a big one, isn't it? Is this the full wine vineyard experience? What is that going to be all about?
You know, like, so we've really worked hard in the last couple of years to change the perception of Colorado wine, to get people to realize that not just us, but a lot of growers and winemakers are making some really fantastic Colorado wine. It's a small industry. And so, so we've been really, from a PR standpoint, not just for our own winery, for Carboy, but also for the Colorado wine industry, we've really been trying to champion Colorado wine. And in that quest, we've always wanted to have, you know, a place out in wine country here in Colorado. You know, we work with all these fantastic growers on the Western Slope, but we really wanted to have a place that we could call home out there. And so we had the opportunity. It kind of came up organically, like the other three locations did, where the owner of Garfield Estates was looking to sell, and we were at the right place at the right time, and we swooped in and we were able to get it, and we bought 11 and a half acre vineyard with a existing tasting room. And so we'll be and then we purchased another 20 acre vineyard nearby. And so we'll be opening the doors to Carboy Winery at Mount Garfield Estate, a soft open sometime this summer. We're aiming for July. We just planted the vineyard a couple weeks ago. So it'll be 2 years before those vines start producing.
I was going to ask you if you were going to keep the same vines or if you brought in new vines or what that process is like.
We ripped out pretty much the whole thing, minus a few obscure varieties that we were really excited to work with. So it's a complete replanting. And like I said earlier, it kind of coincided with a really unfortunate freeze event last October that really did some significant damage to the grape crop out there. So we were going to have to replant anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and we're going to shut it down in the fall after harvest, and we'll do a major renovation of the existing tasting room that's there and add about 4,000 square feet of production space, including the Charmant tanks for making sparkling wine.
I'm
and then
so excited.
2022 in the spring, we're going to open up the grand opening for Carboy Winery at Mount Garfield Estate, and it'll have a 360-degree rooftop patio that looks at the Book Cliffs and Mount Garfield and all over the valley. And
this sounds like it's going to be a place where people are going to be doing a lot of getting married on those with those kind of views. You know, I mean, that's
you're going to go do the Palisade plunge, and then you're going to go and you're going to drink wine afterwards. It's going to be beautiful.
Well, you know, what do you see for the overall? You just mentioned that there's a lot of really good people making good wine in Colorado. What do you see the industry? Where are we now? Are we in our infancy, our toddlerhood, our childhood? Where are we? Because I feel like it all kind of started again in 1970 with real vigor. You know, that's when we started moving forward.
Yeah. You know, as far as the Colorado wine industry goes, I think we're still in our toddler years. And I have two toddlers, so I know what those years are like.
Yeah.
There's a lot of learning and a lot of growth, and with a lot of us having to replant out there, and there's challenges, and it's going to take some time, because like I said, you only get one harvest every year. So but as a national industry, you know, there's a lot of challenges. You know, California has had, you know, four straight years, I think, of wildfires, smoke taint issues. You know, there's climate change happening, and that's, you know, that's how a lot of this, you know, that's how that freeze event actually happened this past October here in Colorado, because it got so hot in October that when it finally plunged down to the 30s, in a seemingly two-day time period, the grapes had not gone into vines had not gone into dormancy and hibernation, for lack of a better term, and so they were kind of exposed, and which caused some damage. And in California, they're dealing with those kind of things. But on top of those viticultural challenges, there's a huge changing of the guard from a consumer standpoint. Baby boomers are retiring. They're not spending as much money on wine anymore. Wine prices keep going up, especially in Napa. And then the newest, the largest buying segment for consumers is millennials and Gen Zers. And they have so many choices. They have thousands of craft breweries and distilleries mm-hmm. all over the place. And as they grow older, the challenge for the wine industry is how do you get them to evolve their taste to wine from those craft beer?
Don't you think that evolution almost happens? It's almost like a rite of passage in some ways. My friends and I were early adopters of wine, but we used to go to these wine tastings. Now, this was back in the 90s. So the early 90s, we'd go to wine tastings. We would be the youngest people there by 15 years. When we were in our early 20s. So I think that there's something about your shifting palate, maybe your level of sophistication, maybe feeling like you're not pounding Long Island iced teas anymore, that kind of comes with a little bit of seasoning on yourself,
Yeah, we have to, that's a good point. And, like I said, it's, I started drinking wine in my late 20s, but there was always this kind of feeling like you got to be in the know to really enjoy it. There was this sophistication and there's almost this air of pretentiousness that surrounded, wine for me at that age, to where I kind of, it just didn't feel as approachable and accessible to me as something I'm going to choose to drink. It wasn't until I had the education and grew along with it that I really felt and drew an appreciation to it. So when I think about consumers in their 20s and 30s, now and all the choices that they have and what the challenges, I think of the wine industry as having to start making a product that's not really pricey, that's not, because they're not going to spend that money, but also making something that doesn't require a book to understand it. When we opened up Carboy, my biggest goal was, I want somebody to sit, I want some in Denver to be able to sit next to someone who's never really known a lot about wine. They just know what they like to drink, and they both leave with the same experience. So we wanted to remove that pretentiousness from wine and make it really approachable and fun. And I think that's some of the things that the wine industry in whole has to do to grab these new consumers and make it fun, make it innovative, make it tasty, make it affordable. Those kind of things.
Dave, did you have a question?
Yeah. What if I'm a Coloradoan and I want to try all the Colorado wines. I want to see them all in one place. Rather than go to a wine store, you have one or two varieties. Where do I go to get the whole spectrum of Colorado wines?
That's an interesting question because, there's some really great winemakers out there that, just because they're so, they're in Cedar Edge or Hotchkiss or Paonia, or, maybe they're so far away from the Front Range, they don't really distribute their wines. So there is, I don't want to say that, festivals are a great way for you to go and experience all of them, because not all of them participate in those things. So, the beauty of Colorado is we all love taking road trips around our beautiful state, right? So I think, the best way, in my opinion, would be to pack an overnight bag and head out west and loop through Grand Junction and come down through Delta and into the West Elks AVA near Hotchkiss and Paonia and visit some tasting rooms, and then really get to see what they're doing and see some of the best out there. But if you're wanting to make it hit an easier button, there's lots of festivals like the Colorado Mountain Wine Fest and Palisade. We're having an event at our Denver location on June 4th, and there's still tickets available. There's two sessions. We basically contacted some of our friends in the wine industry here and said, hey, we want to do an inaugural rosé event here in Denver, and we're going to call it Rosé La La La, make it really fun. So there's going to be 13 participating Colorado wineries. The prereqs were that they had to make rosé, and they had to be interested in distributing it to the public in the Front Range. And so we're going to have this event on our brand new courtyard in Denver. And that's a great example of where you can go to see some really great winemakers and their wines that they're making. And like I said, there's two sessions. The afternoon session's already sold out. The earlier session that starts at 3:30, there's still about 60 tickets left for it. So anybody that's looking for an early happy hour on Friday, June 4th, 3:30, you know, knock work off. And, you know, you're working from home anyway, so you might as well just take off and go drink some wine with us. So
you guys have two events, that one and the wine dinner, and both of them fall on a time when I am on my way out of town. So I was super irritated about that one. The wine dinner itself looks amazing. Who is your chef?
So our founding chef at Carboy, his name is Scott Hibbeneth. Scott is, I think, one of the most amazing chefs that doesn't get enough press in Denver. He's worked at Barolo Grill, Sushi Den. He runs the culinary program at both Angelo's Tavernas. But he is just such an amazing chef that we're so lucky to have. So he's doing this dinner, and this is the first wine dinner that we've done at Carboy where we're actually collaborating with a couple other wineries here in Colorado. And I think that's really important because we are such a tight-knit community here in Colorado, mm-hmm. and in every industry, but especially in the wine industry, that we really wanted to show that, you know, we're here, you know, we're on this huge growth, you know, steep growth pattern here at Carboy, but we're all about collaboration, not competition. And so we wanted to, you know, it's fun for us to get together with some of our friends at other wineries and do some things like this where we can pair our wines with amazing food and hopefully have people start asking for it on restaurant menus and liquor store shelves and see what we're doing.
All right. Kevin Weber with Carboy Winery. I put a link on the blog today. I went to the location on, Santa Fe. It's like in Littleton. Outstanding location. And we didn't even talk about the meat, Kevin. We didn't even talk about the charcuterie that you guys have. You guys, they have a little room. Dave, it's like a meat aquarium. You just look at all of this meat curing as it's just absorbing all the flavor from all the seasonings. And then it turns into something beautiful and they slice it and put it on a plate. Oh,
I'm going to trademark that, Mandy. You better trademark
a meat aquarium. No, feel free. The meat aquarium right there. You can watch it. It's who makes that? Who makes that?
Chef Scott does. He took a bunch of classes a long time ago on how to cure his own meats. And so, you know, just like a winery where you're at each harvest, you hope to accumulate a native yeast in the air, you know, mm-hmm. in that room, there's some native molds and it's beautiful.
Oh, it's outstanding. It's outstanding. Just outstanding. Anyway, Kevin, thank you so much. Go to Carboy Winery. I love their wine. They have so much variety that I have a hard time thinking that they don't have something that you would enjoy. Honestly. I mean, don't you feel that? Really, Kevin?
You know, I never get bored. There's always something fun and new. And we just bottled about 1,000 cases over the weekend. So We've got a lot for a lot of different people, a lot of different palates. So come down with a thirsty appetite to learn and to drink wine. So
do you guys do daily tastings, don't you?
Yeah, we do daily tastings. We do tours by appointment on our website. We do virtual tastings. Corporate virtual tastings really took off in 2020. Yeah. So we do a lot of those, and then we do wine dinners. We have a wine club that's, you know, pushing, you know, 1,500 wine club members, and where it's growing all the time, and we have some really fun, unique things that we offer our membership. And so we've got a lot of different things that can keep a person interested. So.
All right. That's Kevin Weber with Carboy Winery. Thank you so much, Kevin. You will see me again very, very soon. Not at this wine dinner, dang it, but I'm coming to one very, very soon.
We'll have
based
another
on
one,
the
I
menu.
Promise,
I was going to say, you had me at Buffalo Carpaccio. And then I got all excited and I told Crystal, yes, let's do it. And then I realized I can't because I'm going to be helping
next
my
one's
mother.
In July in Denver.
Okay.
So make sure you know about it.
All right. Check it out. Find out more, Kevin. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Mandy. Nice.
All right. Thank you. We will be back after we check in with Susan Witkin. Find out what is happening in her news.
The president is meeting with GOP senators and both sides say, hey, this was a productive meeting. Find out about it at 2 o'clock on KOA News Radio, 850 AM and 94.1 FM.
The Mandy Connell Show is sponsored by Bell and Pollock Accident and Injury Lawyers.
Now, it's Mandy Connell on KOA News Radio, the voice of Colorado.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the third hour of the show. I'm here. Dave the Intrepid is here and Michael Coover filling in for Grant right now. We are about ready to have the big wheel of the day, but Grant took the keys to the actual big wheel. So Coove has managed to unearth another wheel to pick the word of the day out of the book of questions. I put a link to buy the book of questions if you'd like to. It's not my book. I wish I thought of it. But on the blog today, so check it out. Okay, Coove, do you have the spinning wheels? Is it ready to go?
I do. Are you ready
okay,
for
here
it?
Here we go. Oh, that's impressive. I didn't think it was going to go that fast.
I didn't either.
Oh, what number is that, Dave? What number do you see?
That's number 277.
277. Okay, here we go.
On
so
the
what
big
is our
wheel. Big,
big,
big
question
wheel
of the day. Coove, you're going to have to weigh in on this, so pay attention.
Okay. If you could put a near-perfect lie detector on your phone to flag any dishonesties, would you? And if so, would you use it a lot or just for very specific conversations?
So you put a little lie detector app on your phone, and when somebody is lying, it goes wah, 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 or something.
Or
like
a red
that
light goes off, something yeah like that.
So is this for like phone calls or just anything that's out there on the web?
Any community. Oh, I didn't even think about it. That aspect, Coove. Wait a minute. That's game changing right there. Because for calls and text messages, I don't want that. And here's why. Because ultimately, I believe that humanity is good. And I know that sometimes I'm super snarky and negative, but really, I promise you, I believe that overall, human beings are good people and good things. And I think that coupled with the fact that people lie to you all the time to spare your feelings, just to be kind, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I don't want to ruin that dynamic. But also, it would just seem, I think it would make me feel very paranoid and untrusting. And I think I have a really good BS detector, you know, but could I put the truth detector on my Google app? Could I put it on the internet? I would take that in a New York minute, in a heartbeat.
Yeah. According to the question, it's just the phone, but you can make it anything you like. I've been thinking of this and going back and forth on it. I think I'd like to reserve the ability to do it because I don't know, but I know there's going to be some phone call I'm going to get at some point where I'm going to think, I don't believe that, and I want to know the truth. But in general, with my friends and acquaintances, I think I agree with you for the most part. Whenever I call customer service, I would activate it.
Okay. So when they say, I'm sorry, we can't escalate your call. I'm so sorry. We can't escalate your call.
And when I'm arguing with the DMV, I want that activated.
Situationally, okay, I could see your point. Situationally, yeah, you know.
But in general, I agree with you, no.
Coove?
I think that I would definitely put it, because I like to, when I go to the doctor, as I've said, I've been in the hospital a few times, I like to go on the Google to look at what's wrong with me. And that's obviously not a great thing to do, because most of the time, Google doesn't actually tell you always the truth. And but I would like to know that when I do go there, if I do, to find out what's wrong with me and how I can help myself, that I would know what I was getting to be true. Well, and not some like thrown out there, 200 out of 500 people actually have this disease, but that's just lying. It's really only 10 out of 500.
Well, Coove, here's the thing. First of all, I am actually putting together a web course on how to be an effective internet doctor. So I'll give you a free membership to that.
Because Mandy is a licensed internet physician.
Sweet.
I'm a legendary internet doctor. Yes. I don't just, you know, I'm not just using WebMD. Okay, that's for amateurs. You don't just go to Google, Anthony. Excuse me, Michael. I'm being disparaging, and Anthony's not even here to get it. That's disappointing. That's how bonded.
Whenever I have an ache or pain, I go to Mandy first.
Exactly. Dr. Mandy can help you.
Yes.
I'm right way more than I'm wrong. I just want to say that.
Oh, that's full. Well, see, that was going to be my next question. Are you right or are you wrong? Am I going to be getting the red light going off on my phone
if I go to you? I'm right. I'm telling you right now. You walk in and you say, look, I've consulted my internet doctor and this is what she thinks it is. First of all, they're going to roll their eyes at you, and then you'll see their eyes get wide in amazement as they realize that I am correct in my diagnosis. Correct.
But I agree with Dave, though, on the calling people, regardless of who it is, whether it be working with the cable company, the phone company, or whoever it may be, as they raise my bill up, up, and up. And I would like to know that, yes, I really do have this deal over here for you, Mr. Coover. Yes, you can get like 3 free months of our cable service.
Now, I see that purpose, but I think that I feel like this question is directed more at interpersonal relationships. And if it's interpersonal relationships, I think if you jump on this and say yes, and by the way, we welcome your thoughts on this, 303-713-8585, or text us at 56690. I'd love to, I think if your go-to position is heck yes, I would absolutely do that. You need to evaluate your interpersonal relationships. And I'm being serious, because if your first instinct is everyone is lying to me and this would help me find out, you've got some issues that probably need to be addressed.
So what if I think my wife might be cheating on me?
That's
and
what
I say to her, wait, and I say in the living room, honey, I this is some suspicious stuff going on. Are you seeing someone else? And she's like, no, of course not. And then I call her on her cell phone to find out the truth.
But that's exactly what I'm talking about. You have a bigger issue if you immediately suspect something.
Well, that can happen to anyone, can it?
No. You're missing my whole point. I'm not convicting someone who may be in that situation. I'm being serious when I say if your initial instinct is, yes, I want something on my phone that's going to tell me if anyone's lying, you have some issues with the people that you're in relationships with. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means that something is going on there that you have concerns about that you probably need to address. That's all I'm saying. I'm not making a judgment on anyone who would feel that way. I'm just saying if you do, then you need to really think, why do I feel this way?
It could have been I was just wrong. It was just a bunch of coincidences, and my phone can confirm that. No?
No.
Okay.
No.
I kind of like the feature, though.
Like, if you could flip it on, like if it was like Wonder Woman's lariat, right? Okay.
Yeah, you know, flip it on and off.
Which is, by the way, I still maintain the worst superpower thing ever. The lariat of truth. It's just so dumb. So stupid. God, it makes me mad every time I think about it. Especially because Gal Gadot was so badass. And then it's like, what's your superpower? I have a lariat of truth. I can make people say the truth. Ooh, that's what girls like. Somebody on the text line at 56690 said, I would for every time the governor and the president talks. That would be pretty dang cool.
Hooked into the next presidential press conference.
Amen. Exactly. Although it would just sound like this, like somebody would open their mouth and it'd be like, lies, 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 lies. You know, what does that sounder even sound like? What if the other person could hear it? That would be awesome. Like if somebody said something that wasn't truth and it just went, wah, 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 you're lying. That would be cool.
It would just simply say, liar, liar, pants on fire every mm-hmm. time they told a lie. That would be satisfying.
Maybe, but you know who this would be good for? People in the dating pool. Like if I were dating, if I were back in the dating world, God forbid, knock on wood, please don't let it happen. But if I ever end up back in the dating pool, this would be very, very productive based on what I hear from my friends, you know? And I'm sure it goes the same way with guys. There's no doubt this is not a gender-specific accusation. Apparently, it's just okay to lie about everything.
Oh, did you go to college? Yeah, I graduated Princeton with honors.
Yeah, yeah. Summa cum laude.
Liar, liar, pants on fire.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know. I'd hope that I wouldn't get to a point where I felt so distrusting. That was going to be a good thing.
It's not that you're distrusting. Someone just offers you this. Wouldn't it be nice if you had this? You didn't ask for it, but it was offered to you. That's a nice feature on my phone. Do I have to pay extra for it?
No, let me throw this out, though, Dave. What if you find out that everyone in your life lies to you about everything? And maybe they do it for you know, a perfectly reasonable reason. You know, they don't want to hurt your feelings or whatever. What if you find out that everyone you know lies to you on all the time?
I would probably be very depressed.
Exactly. Exactly my point. This is one of those things.
If everyone lied to me all the time, I would have good reason to be depressed.
Are you happy now not having that information? Let's just.
But it's, I don't think that information exists, though.
But for the sake of this conversation, since this is a hypothetical, philosophical conversation, for the sake of this conversation, let's just say that everyone in your life is lying to you all the time, but they're lying to you well-intentioned, and you go through life perfectly happy. Because you don't know that everyone's lying to you to keep you happy, but you're happy. So who cares? What's going on? Who cares? You know,
so it's like, ignorance is bliss.
Correct.
I don't know if I could live my life like that either.
Ignorance is bliss. I wish there were things I could unknow. Don't you know things in your life that you're like, wow,
there
are
some things, but there are some things that are painful that are good for me to know, though.
I don't know. Kuv?
Here's a good question for you. So back to the medical portion of it. Do you, if your family doesn't live around you, do you let them know if you've been to the hospital or if you've been sick? Or do you try to keep it away from them to let them not stress out about it?
I have been on both sides of this situation where my family kept something from me that was significant. Because I was across the country and they didn't want to bother me and blah, 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 blah. And it sucked to be that me in that situation. It depends on the seriousness of what's going on. But we tend to let like our we have grown children who live in another place. So we keep them up to speed. Hey, we're going to have this procedure done or whatever. Because I don't want to ever call them and say, oh, by the way, your dad just didn't wake up, you know, from a procedure he was having. I mean, there's no best answer here. You have to kind of like what I tell my late now mother-in-law when she was 93 at the end of her life, when she was having a lot of issues, would I have burdened her? No, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have. But my mom, who's young and healthy. Yeah. I would call her and say, hey, this is happening. No big deal. Just wanted you to know. That's all.
Cause I think in some cases people don't do it cause they don't want to stress people out over this, that, and the other. And it's better that they not know. And then after a while, maybe once you know more information, then you kind of let them in. But it's a tough question, especially when people aren't around you. Like, we don't have a whole lot of family here in Colorado. So we've gone both ways on it.
No, I mean, like I said, I've been on both sides of that issue. And I've been on the side where you find out too late that something's super serious and it sucks. So I don't recommend that, but that's me. I don't know. Maybe
I tend to think that always give full information, unless it's going to give the person a heart attack or something if they're very sick.
But that's like, you know, like.
But if it's just going to worry them because they're far away, that's fine. Because I've experienced situations where information was kept from someone not to hurt them. And I think it's a terrible idea, and I think everyone should have that knowledge. I think later on that's going to backfire on you.
I agree on the later on it's going to backfire on you later because you don't know, especially if it could be serious, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to find out last that something serious is going on, and I think in an effort to protect people, you also isolate yourself a little bit when you could probably use some support from the family, if that's the role that your family plays for you. Some people's family is not a supportive environment. I'll just leave it at that. And that's a horse of a different color. But if you have a supportive family, that's a time when you may need that support. And therefore, why not? You know, why not at least give them some clue about what's going on?
And the simple fact that once they find out you withheld information from them, they're never going to believe you again. They're not going to trust you. It's also a trust situation. I get a hangnail, I tell everyone.
That's because you're kind of a whiner, Dave. I don't know if you've ever known this about yourself, but yeah.
It could be true.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit of a, you know, complainer about stuff like
that. By the way, I did find you guys a sounder, by the way, for your lies.
Oh,
you ready for it?
Good. We got, yeah, please.
Good.
With a sounder. I'm excited.
All right, here it goes.
Lies. Oh, lies!
Perfect. I love it.
Fantastic. So that's our sounder when someone lies now.
Yeah.
For our lie detector. 303-713-8585. By the way, if you've been listening to Susan Witkin's news, you have heard now that the CDC has changed its guidance on mask wearing. And now, let me just hang on 1 second. Let me pull this up. And I went to MSNBC, so it would be the most left-wing source available. So nobody could say, that's just right-wing conspiracy crap. Okay, here we go. The updated CDC guidance is that if you are fully vaccinated, you can start doing the things that you had stopped doing because of the pandemic. That includes not wearing a mask and not social distancing if you are fully vaccinated, both indoors
yes.
and outdoors.
Yes.
So I
did
I
you tweeted, hear that, Governor?
Yeah.
Did you hear
well,
that?
I tweeted at him, Dave. I tweeted the article at him and said, when can we expect an announcement? I mean, when?
Like tomorrow would be fine.
What's going to be very interesting is to see what businesses continue to have people wear masks with this new CDC guidance. And I think that in the beginning, you're going to have businesses try and confirm people's vaccine status. And I think that's going to fall away very, very quickly. So, you know, at this stage in the game, here are my thoughts on where we are being vaccinated and everything, Dave. No, you know what? I'm going to hold that thought. I'll tell you on the other side of the break. That's a tease right there.
Good one.
Tease. I am a professional at this.
I wouldn't Susan even Witkin, try that.
Susan Witkin is coming up yes. to tell us what is coming up in her news.
So one man's definition of harassment is different than another's. I bet you can guess who that guy is. And I'll tell you at 2:30 on KOA News Radio, 850 AM and 94.1 FM.
Talking about the question of the day, I do want to make an announcement. Today at 1:55, a black Jeep with Texas plates. It is a four-door Jeep, black with black rims. It was stolen near 51st and Chambers. There is a two-year-old child in the back seat of this Jeep. So this isn't just a stolen car. It was last seen traveling eastbound on Green Valley Ranch at Chambers. If you see this Jeep, please call 911. Again, it's a four-door black Jeep with Texas plates, nubby tires, and a kid in the back. I hope the criminals who stole it just pull over and get out and leave the kid there. Anyway, so Dave was asking the question. What's the question, Dave?
If you could put a near-perfect detector on your phone to flag any dishonesties, would you? And if so, would you use it a lot or just for very specific conversations? So do you want a lie detector on your phone? Now, I thought of another aspect of this. Now, if you have one, you can expect that people you're talking to might have one. And with that knowledge, is that going to change you from lying on the phone to your friends and acquaintances?
I try not to lie on the phone to my friends and acquaintances. I read a study a long time ago when the Q was a baby that said, if you want to know why your children think lying is okay, they watch you do it every day. And it was as simple as, hey, I'm super busy right now. I have to get off the phone when you're sitting on your butt not doing anything. So I sort of made a mental note to try. And by the way, I have been known to lie to get off the phone. I want to be perfectly clear about that. But I try really hard not to, because it's so easy to say, hey, I'm exhausted. I kind of just want to get off the phone. You know, if you say that, people are like, oh, that's fine. Don't worry about it. I say that. That's the truth. Or, hey, I've just had a lot of talking today. I don't really want to talk on the phone. I say that to my friends a lot as well. So I don't know. It certainly would make me think that.
But what if it's a person that, you know, is an acquaintance and you really don't want to talk to him, and you know, once you get started, you're on for an hour with this person?
I don't answer those calls. I don't answer calls from people that I feel that way about. You know, text me. Let's see what you need here. Like, see what's going on in this phone call. Text me first. Does anybody just call anymore without texting first? Coov, do you call before? Do you just call random, just like a wild person, just calling people left and right? What's happening with that?
It just depends. It varies. I usually will text people for this job, and if they don't answer back after a while, then I'll call them because I have an 818 number, and sometimes locally people look at 818 and don't answer it.
Oh, yeah. I almost didn't answer when you called me earlier. See, but my curiosity about, I just wanted to see if they were calling about my car's extended warranty.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It was like, yeah, I just wanted that extended warranty. But it's interesting how phone calling has evolved, you know?
I absolutely just call people.
Yeah.
I'm not going to text them first. It's like you call someone before you drop by. That's polite. You don't just come to someone's house and knock on the door. But you don't have to text as a prerequisite for a phone call. Come on.
Now, see, here's the thing, though, Dave. If I need to have a specific conversation with someone, I'll use my boss as an example. Our boss is a busy guy, you know? And if I need an answer or I need to just, and a lot of times I will text him to say, hey, is now a good time? Or can I call you in an hour or whatever? Because he's busy. But I also want to remind myself that I'm supposed to call him because sometimes I forget. And I don't, you know, I don't know. I
think a business call is different. I mean, you're calling your friends, say, hey, how you're doing? Do I have to text you first and prepare you? I don't think so. Do you do that? Or do you just call? If you call me, you just call me. That's fine.
I call because you're a caller. You call. I know you're a phone guy.
I'm like talking to a person.
I know, and that's why
we can eliminate. We can finish this in 1 or 2 minutes. If we keep texting back and forth, it'll take a half hour. Let's just talk.
I know. I try to make my my texts as complete as they need to be, so there are as few of them as possible. That's what you know. And I tell people when I need to talk
for the show.
Hey, quick question for you about time off, or hey, I've got to talk to you about this, or whatever. That way, they have the right mindset calling me back. Give them a little prep work there.
When I'm booking people for the show, I'll be talking to the person. They'll say, can we do this by text? Can we do this by email? No, I'm talking to you right now.
Because they're 25 and they need a paper trail. They need some kind of paper trail. There are times when we get off the phone, I say, can you text me that? I did it to you the other day. Because I knew I wasn't going to remember what we were just talking about. So I said, text me those names.
Right. Well, that's a convenience. It's not a requirement here.
I know. I'm just saying. Yeah. I think the times they are changing. I know.
Not for the better, though.
No, in this respect, no. I know young people that I'm pretty sure don't know how to properly answer a group phone. Meaning, like, you know, we used to have a family phone when I was a kid. We didn't have our own phones. We didn't have cell phones. But we had the family.
Can you
phone
just say Connell residence? Can I help you?
Yeah. No, we didn't do that. But we did have to say hello and then have a nice conversation and all of that stuff. Like the Q, she was 10 years old, I think. And I realized she had no idea how to answer the phone. She just picked it up and turned it on and stood there. And I went, are you going to say hello? And she was like, oh, hello. And I looked at my husband. I go, how did we fail this? How do we fail this?
But some things you take for granted that you really shouldn't, you know?
No. And
that everyone's born with the ability to answer a phone properly.
Oh, good. Coop just said they found the kid with a Jeep. So I'm excited about that. That's done with. Thank you. I'd hate to have another horrible story to report right there. But no, I do think that for me, a phone call, this is from a text line, Dave. A phone call is an interruption. It is courtesy today's day to text, just a sign of the times. My friend and I text, is it a good time to call and chat? See, that's what I do to my friends. Well, you know, do you have time for a call? So, yeah, we kind of schedule it. And it's partly a function of being busy.
If you're busy, leave a message. But at least you're speaking to a person. It's so impersonal, the text thing.
It is impersonal. Absolutely. I agree with that. That's why I send long, detailed, out, you know, 3-page text messages that you have to scroll. I want to get as much in there as make it feel personal. I'm just kidding. I don't really do that. Sometimes I do. I have been known to send a...
I do that, but I use the dictation feature
too.
On my phone. And then it gets things wrong. And I have to erase it and type it out anyway. And it's... can't we just talk and avoid all this?
I really feel like this is a generational thing, though, Dave.
I think you're right.
I really do. It's a generational thing. And this this group of kids that have come up, you know, the millennials were the first generation that came up fully digital. I'm a Gen X, so I was part of the transition generation where we, when I was a kid, and I jokingly say things to my daughter all the time, you know, where we're like, when I was a kid, we had a phone that was attached to the wall and we had to turn the dial. And when there was a radio contest, you had to turn as fast as you could and it was terrible. And she's looking at me like, that's not real. That's not a thing, Mom. Like, yes, in the old times, in the olden days. You know, there's still things that
in
pop
the dark
up when,
times.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. I cannot remember what we were talking about. She said to me, this is adorable. You guys, I'm 51. She's 12. OK, so just keep that in mind as I tell this story. She comes up to me and she goes, ugh, Mom, do you remember when you were a kid and you got a song stuck in your head and you had to look it up everywhere you could find it and play it over and over and over again so you could just hear it as many times as possible? And I said, no. But I remember when I was a kid, you'd have to race across the living room, jump over the couch and slide to record your song on a cassette player where you always missed the first few notes because you didn't know it was coming up so you could listen to the song over and over again. And she looked at me and was like, what? And I was like, we didn't have the internet to look things up. What? It's beyond her scope that the internet.
Any
was not
song in the universe is on YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
right
like
there
little,
at your beck yeah. and call.
Like I'm Laura Ingalls Wilder all of a sudden. Like I was going out to, you know, spin the wool for us to make our clothes back in the old
times. Remember when you used to listen to hit radio stations and the number one song would be played approximately every half hour?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So you miss the beginning in a half hour, you're ready. And then you can record it, and then you have the song.
Mm-hmm,
as long as the jock didn't talk over it and mess it up for you.
That was the thing. Back then, I didn't know the lingo, but now I know it's, you know, don't talk it up. Don't talk it up. Because, you know, that's what they do on the music stations. It's true, though. All of it's true. Kids, it was tough back then.
You whippersnappers don't know how good you have it.
Yeah, but they don't have to communicate via real words. So, you know, it would be really cool if somebody made a dystopian future movie where no one talks. They just communicate through boxes in their hands. You know,
this may be our future.
No, you'll be dead by then. Well, let me grab Melissa very quickly. She wants to talk about texting versus calling. Hey, Melissa, you are on KOA News Radio.
Hey, Mandy and Dave. So my particular instance is I appreciate the texting because somebody can say, is it a good time to talk? And then I can say, okay, I can put my leg on and go back and stand in my master closet because that's pretty much the only place I have good, reliable cell service, period.
See,
so that's my issue.
I live in one of those places, too, and so much so that I just had a conversation with someone where she called my cell phone, and I said, hey, can you call me back on a landline? On the landline, she goes, you have a landline? I'm like, because I can't hear you on my cell phone.
I don't have a landline either.
Oh,
so
golly.
It's kind of fun.
No.
But most people already have their legs on, so that's my own particular story. But in the evenings, I take it off. Instead of taking off my bra, I take off my leg.
Okay, Dave, there you go. If you ever go to call Melissa, you're going to want to text her so she can put her leg back on. Just saying.
Exactly.
Okay, in that case,
and I would appreciate that.
I will do that in your case.
All right. Melissa, I appreciate it very much. There's nothing going on there that you have a response for, mister. When someone says, I need time to put my leg on, by gosh, by golly, you're going
to
get time to put
your leg back
on.
There are exceptions to every rule, Mandy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know. Rob has joined us. Hang on. He can't hear me yet. Got to do this over here. All righty then. Rob has joined us, and I think BK is going to join us too, and because it's almost time. You're muted, Rob. You got to unmute yourself. Rob has now, he's a bald man with a dark mustache and a gray beard, and he's wearing a black shirt with gray sleeves. It looks like you color coordinated your beard to your shirt today.
Well, yeah, I'm a civilian now. Of course, I'm a fashion icon.
Oh, yeah. Fashion. I think, Rob, fashionista right away. As a matter of fact, I was going to ask you if you'd be my personal shopper from this point forward. Make that happen.
If it makes you feel any better, I will never wear green again.
There you go. Dave, come to Zoom here because now it's time for the most exciting segment on the radio of its kind in the world of the day. All right, let's see here. I want to make sure that we don't
By the way, okay. For those of you who remember cough drops, Rob looks like one of the Smith brothers.
What?
Thanks,
guys. Cough two guys. What? Two guys had long beards and they had cough drops.
Oh, okay then.
Looked just like Rob.
BK has
I don't
joined
think it's
us.
That long yet?
No, it'll be there soon. BK is here as well. What is our word of the day, please, Dave?
Word of the day is an adjective.
Okay.
And it is abstruse. A-B-S-T-R-U-S-E. Abstruse.
Isn't abstruse a word, too? Is it a word? Abstruse. Abstruse.
This is
say
abstruse.
That's what the warden was in that movie about prisons, The Shawshank Redemption.
No.
It was obtuse, right?
No. Mm-mm. No. Let's see here. I have no
Anybody?
Idea. Abstruse? No I got nothing.
Abstruse. No one?
Is it a kind of
it's
angle?
A
kind of angle?
No, it's an adjective.
Oh, well, never mind then. Go ahead. What is it?
It's difficult to understand or obscure. He was abstruse.
Ah, I feel like we should have known that somehow. Supply. Today's trivia question, which predominantly Roman Catholic country consumes finesca, a kind of codfish soup during Lent?
Brazil.
Ooh.
Spain.
Wrong. Dave?
Lithuania.
Nope. Coov, you want a shot at it?
No idea.
Well, it's Ecuador, in case you were all wondering. In addition to the...
Yeah.
You were closest, Brandon. I almost said you're in the right region, but then I realized that would give everybody else an edge. In addition to the codfish, which symbolizes Jesus, who knew? The soup often features 12 different grains or beans and vegetables representing the 12 apostles. That is the most Catholic soup ever. Okay.
Doesn't sound good.
What is our Jeopardy category, please, Dave?
Category for today is a little food and drink.
Okay.
Okay. Too bad Crystal's not here.
Here we go. Though it triggered an E. coli scare in 2006, this...
Rob?
Yes?
Go ahead, Rob.
What is lettuce?
That is wrong.
Say the rest of the question.
Though it triggered an E. coli scare in 2006, this leafy vegetable is generally safe to eat. Ask Popeye.
Mandy.
Brandon.
Ah. That was a tie.
We both know the answer, so do we each get...
No.
Half a point?
No. I gave it to you the other day. I'm taking it today. So, yep. Right. I will say, what is spinach?
That is correct.
Okay.
wild guess. Yeah, this city sandwich consists of thin slices of beef, slices of American, and often sautéed onions
Mandy.
On a roll.
Rob.
Ah,
what is Philadelphia?
Wrong.
What cities? What?
Not Philadelphia?
I said this city sandwich.
Oh, okay.
Rob. Oh,
sorry.
Rob.
What is the Philly cheesesteak sandwich?
Yeah,
That's correct.
Rob at zero, I'm at zero. We are burning this category up. Let's do it.
Next one. Though often referred to as a wine, this Japanese alcohol
Mandy.
Is actually... God, you guys are close.
Coov, did you hear who was closer?
I would go Mandy.
All right. What is sake?
Pandering.
What is the answer?
What is sake?
Correct.
And she pronounced it correctly.
That's yes.
Bonus points.
This candy bar of chocolate nougat. Peanuts and caramel.
Mandy. Oh, Brandon got that one.
Brandon.
What is Snickers?
Correct.
Yep.
I like this, though. Named for a horse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. And finally, this cereal once had a longer name. Oats became O's.
Mandy?
Mandy.
What are...
Brandon.
Rob?
Shoot. Go ahead, Rob.
Rob.
I think Brandon was first.
Yeah, Brandon was first. Yeah.
Brandon,
what are Quaker Oats? Not Quaker Oats.
That's wrong.
Oh!
Rob.
What are Cheerios?
You are correct.
Oh, my God. And Rob wins with one.
As
Brandon and
I both
go back to zero with a wrong answer. Never give up your dreams, kids. Never
Cheerios
give up.
Still called Cheerios. I have three different types of Cheerios
in your house. You know what I love to do, Brandon? Here's a little pro tip for you. Mix half Honey Nut Cheerios, Honey Nut Chex. You're welcome.
Oh, Honey Nut Chex.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm just doing regular Cheerios with Honey Nut Cheerios to
break up
the sugar.
Yeah. No, try it with the Honey Nut Chex. You're welcome. Okay.
If it's not Cocoa Pebbles, it's not happening.
Oh, chocolate fake.
So, quick story, Mandy.
Yes.
Not that anybody listening can see it, but... We were up in the mountains, and I had a thing of candy in my backpack, and the 2-year-old grabs it. My wife's like, what is that? and it was those Airhead strips.
Uh-huh.
And so she's grabbing it, almost like the drug addict as they're pouring drugs down the toilet. He's like, no, and he's jamming it into his mouth. She's yanking it away, and I'm just sitting on the couch laughing. But
well done, Dad. Well done.
Like his dad.
Yeah, next level dad right there. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got the movie show. We've got something else too. I don't remember what.
We're reviewing.
I don't know. There are two movies that did not interest me whatsoever, so I've already tapped out. I'm like, I'm not going to watch it. Well, one of them is a horror movie.
One is a revenge movie.
No, one of them is a horror movie. I'm like, I don't want to watch that. And the other one just did not. Yeah, no, I'm not down with that. Well, let's make way. Big Al and JoJo ready to take things over. We'll be back tomorrow on KOA News Radio.